This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hi everyone, and welcome to today's episode of the Professional Book Nerds Podcast presented by Overdrive. I'm having a rough morning, y'all. I think I've recorded this intro like 4 times, no joke. It's not even morning. Why did I say morning? It's 3:30 on a Monday. So I obviously recorded it in advance because you are listening to this Monday morning. So I did not, you know, this is not a time traveling thing. So today's episode is an interview I did with Chloe Gong about her new book, Our Violent Ends. This is the second in a duology. The first was These Violent Delights, which was a huge bestseller. The books are a Romeo and Juliet retelling set in 1920s Shanghai with monsters. Feel like I don't really need to sell you too much more on the book. 1920s Shanghai, Romeo and Juliet with monsters, like actual monsters. Also, Chloe was like in college when she wrote or when she published These Violent Delights. So I don't know what you were doing when we were 20. I was not publishing a New York Times bestseller. So good times. So the books, though, are so good. I had so much fun chatting with Chloe about Our Violent Ends, These Violent Delights, the whole world that she has created. And I'm really looking forward to all of you listening to this episode. If you want to get a hold of the podcast, you can go to the website, professionalbooknerds.com. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at ProBookNerds. You can always email us at professionalbooknerds@overdrive.com. I think that's everything. So I hope you enjoy this episode, an interview with Chloe Gong on the Professional Book Nerds podcast. So, hi, Chloe. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Hello. So excited to be here.
So, can you start by giving our listeners a brief introduction to your new book, Our Violent Ends?
Yes, of course. So Our Violent Ends is the sequel to the first book, These Violent Delights. And the two of them are a duology that is basically a Romeo and Juliet retelling set in 1920 Shanghai, following these two rival heirs from gangs that are in a blood feud. And they have a bit of a messy past between them. But when a monster rises in the city, they have to work together to figure out what is happening before all of their people die, which would not be great. So, yeah, Our Violent Ends basically continues on with the second half of the story when, you know, some monsters are back and bigger than ever. There's civil war on the horizon, and Roma and Juliet really, really have to, you know, get themselves together and figure out what's going on and maybe end up in love at the same time.
Maybe. We don't maybe. Know. Yeah, maybe.
You never know.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot that's going on in this, in the two books. And yes, there are like monsters lurking. They're just like actual literal monsters just happening. So what attracted you to 1920s Shanghai as the setting for this kind of Romeo and Juliet retelling? Mm-hmm.
Love this question because I love the 1920s just in general as an aesthetic, right? Like I've always loved the glamour of it, the, I guess like messiness, right? Because this was the interwar period, like just things were happening everywhere, all over the world, just so much going on. And specifically 1920s Shanghai, I had grown up with a lot of stories about it from my parents and from my relatives, because like my whole family is from Shanghai. So they feel very like, I've heard this comparison being made where Chinese people from Shanghai are kind of like New Yorkers, where they will never shut up about the fact that they're from New York and they're native to New York. Found that's very true. So They had always told a lot of stories about, like, oh my God, this was the golden era. Like, it was just this time that, you know, we'll never really experience again. So it's like so locked in history, it's this beautiful time. So I've always had a like inclination towards wanting to like explore it and like, you know, set stories during that time. And then the more I did like research into it, the more I kind of also saw like the darker history behind it and these like ugly parts along with the good parts that kind of made it the aesthetic that it is, right? So as I was thinking, like, you know, Romeo and Juliet retelling, themes of like love and hatred, actually a setting where like all of this beauty and glamour came from the like product of colonialism, imperialism, and like Western intrusion really goes well with these kind of themes I'm trying to tackle. And so I kind of just mushed it together and I was like, huh, this kind of works.
It does. It sure does. It sure does. actually, I wanted to ask about your research a little bit, and we should say, I should say that the first book, These Violent Delights, was published when you were still an undergrad student, which is just sort of amazing on like multiple levels. But I read in an interview you had previously done that when you were in school, you did take advantage of some classes available, like Monsters and Literature and East Asian Diplomacy. Can you talk a little bit more about like the research process you did in general for the duology?
So before I started the first book, I think I did a lot of preliminary research that like I did a lot of the heavy lifting to begin with, because once I got onto the like second book, right, I kind of just dove right in because then I already had so much of like the historical basis that was already like living in my head. But before I dived into the first book, I kind of just really took advantage of the fact that like my school had a giant library, and I would just show up and just sit in like the 1920s China section and just kind of flip through like every book that like that was there. And I ended up not using a lot of it because, like, you know, it's a work of fiction and it can't turn into a textbook because that would just not be the purpose I was trying to do. I was really fascinated by a lot of it. I did want to put it in, but then there was a certain point where my agent was like, Chloe, you might need to cut this. It reads like a textbook. And I was like, yeah, you're right. You're right. I did pull right from the textbook. So that was like, I think I was at a like huge advantage to even having those textbooks like accessible to me to just be able to have so much information like right at my fingertips. But I didn't actually take the academic classes that helped with the book until I actually had a first draft. So I wrote the first book, like of These Violent Delights, between my freshman and sophomore year in the summer. And freshman year classes were all like a lot of the core curriculum. And then it was sophomore year where I started picking the things I was really interested in. So that was the year I took like, I think that was the year. Yeah, that was the year I took like the Monsters in Film and Literature, East Asian Diplomacy, Intro to Russian Lit. And I kind of just happened to be drawn to those things anyway because I was interested in it. And because, you know, I write books about the things I'm interested in, they kind of like merged together in the sense that like the class that I was taking, I was like, oh wow, I can use these things. I can put insert them into my like manuscripts. So, you know, there'd be certain things I pick up like in English classes, there'd be discussions about how, you know, monsters in literature are often like stand-ins for other things that, you know, are fair, like physical manifestations of fears that you can't necessarily perceive, like if you don't put a monster as a stand-in. I was like, I think that's so interesting. Let me lean into that more in my own manuscript. Or in this was, I think, later with the second book. As I was revising it, I was still with that. I took another class from that same Russian lit professor, and just randomly on like a Thursday night, I was emailing like, "Hello, sir, I have a question about Russian jewels. This has nothing to do with class. I just know that you're gonna know, so please help me." So, a lot of the professors had to put up with my strange questions that were kind of related to the class content. I was like, I'm just taking advantage of, you know, my academic like student life.
I mean, that is actually really smart, though. I think that's really smart. And I mean, the classes are there, the professors are there.
Exactly.
Like you said, you write books about things you're interested in, you study things you're interested in. It all makes perfect sense. I think
Exactly.
it's really smart.
Yes.
And you said that there was stuff you cut because it came sort of sound like a textbook, but I feel like even if it's not included, it probably helped kind of put things in context for you about what that time period was like.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, there were a lot of things where even if it didn't make its way in, having read it and then having kind of absorbed, like, these firsthand accounts of what they were witnessing in history or like the general atmosphere kind of helped me create the world. So even if I didn't like, word for word pluck a description of a historical event, it was like having this knowledge made the world feel more real to me. And then as I was writing it, I could make it feel real to the reader, even as I inserted, fictional things like these fictional gangs and a monster and a madness.
Monster and madness. That kind of, yeah, that describe things. You have since graduated, correct?
Yes,
From
graduated this year. Yes.
awesome. Well, first, congratulations. That's very
Thank
exciting.
you.
Was the process with Our Violent Ends any easier since you don't have to try and balance schoolwork with the book?
It kind of came, it was a bit of a strange experience because I think Our Violent Ends was a lot easier for me to write because I was so used to like the dual life of like student life and writing. But I also wrote the majority of Our Violent Ends when lockdown started. So it was like a lot of like just new things suddenly thrown into like the mix of it. So I drafted it quite early on because I wanted to leave myself a lot of buffer time. And it was during the time where I was doing like Zoom classes from home. So I'm from New Zealand. So I flew 16 hours back home on a time difference. So Zoom classes are happening for me at like 3 a.m. And I was like, I'm not
Oh
going
my
to college
gosh.
anymore. I'm just not doing it. So I ended up just having like writing time in the daytime. I was just sitting on the couch, just writing all the time. So in that sense, it was absolutely so much easier for me to just, write as an author. And now, now that I've graduated, I'm just, full time doing authory stuff. So it is like it's felt so much more easier than having to juggle everything at once. But, then now we have a global pandemic. So
I mean, yeah, that's not
that's
great. That's not great.
Yeah.
The pandemic's not great. But that's interesting. I hadn't really considered that you would have gone back to New Zealand at the start of the pandemic. So yeah, your time zones would have been a little different than everybody
Yeah,
else's.
a little rough.
I imagine there was like a lot of coffee if you were a coffee drinker.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
And now we'll take a quick break for word from this week's sponsor. The stresses of this last year, it's more important than ever to practice living healthier and happier lives. So, what if a few moments was all it took to change your relationship with stress and anxiety, transforming your life for the better? Our thoughts can be confusing enough. Meditation doesn't have to be. Headspace is your convenient dose of meditation, mindfulness, and sleep exercises to relieve stress and anxiety and help you get a good night's sleep, all in one app, making it easy to catch your breath and make time for your mental health. And it's one of the most science-backed meditation apps in the world, proving meditation works. A study proves in just 2 weeks, Headspace can reduce your stress by 14%. Personally, I have trouble in the middle of the night when anxiety, insomnia keeps me up and my mind will not stop talking. And so I love being able to fill that voice with the voice of Headspace, which will help me have a moment of peace among my chaos of my brain and help me fall back asleep. Find some Headspace at headspace.com/PBN and get 1 month free of their entire meditation library. This is the best Headspace offer available, so go to headspace.com/PBN today. That's headspace.com/PBN. Okay, now this is a bit of a tricky one because we don't want to spoil anything, but this is, as you said, a Romeo and Juliet retelling, and that particular Shakespeare play is not known for having a happy ending. I guess, how do you work through that? Because just again, like it's Romeo and Juliet, and you put your own twist on it, of course, but again, it's not known for having a happy ending.
I love the way you put that. Like,
I'm just,
not
I mean,
quite.
like, I don't want to spoil anything for readers, but it's very clear from, that you're very open and transparent about how this is a Romeo and Juliet retelling. And so, how much do readers go in expecting it to be that way all the way through? And then are there surprises along the way? Just sort of like how you kind of navigate that in general.
Yeah. I think the thing I love so much about doing retellings is that readers do go in with expectations. And I really love that because then it gives me the chance to subvert them and actually bring surprise that way. So I know a lot of times people are like, oh, well, if you do a retelling, isn't everything going to be predictable, right? And to that, it's like, actually, no, like it's actually really fun to. If you're doing a retelling as opposed to something completely like original storyline wise, right? People go in being like, oh, well, this is what I already know of the original source, and therefore these plot events, this is what I'm expecting. And then I can kind of work with that and go, oh, well, okay, I'm gonna give you this one and this one, but then just as you're comfortable, I'm gonna change the last one, right? And I think that's so fun because I love Romeo and Juliet so much. And there are certain parts of it that I think could be redone even further to then kind of lean into what I'm trying to do, right? Because I love the original Shakespearean themes of it, but when I do it in like These Violent Delights and Our Violent Ends, I've kind of put a completely new lens on it. So I can take some things as they are, and then some other things, because of this new world I've dropped the characters into, it would make more sense to go another route. And I think it's so fun. I keep saying that word fun. I'm sure readers don't think it's very fun while they're crying and like screaming at the pages. But I think it's so fun to then kind of like take pivots that they don't expect. And they're like, oh, okay, I see what you've done here compared to the original source and compared to now what you're trying to achieve. So, all that to say, like, I think just because it's a retelling, it doesn't guarantee anything, right? Like, I can pivot on certain things, I can choose not to pivot on certain things. So, you never know what you're gonna end up getting. It's still a surprise.
It is still a surprise. No, that is very true. And that is a good way of describing it and explaining it. I think you're right, though. I love retellings as well for that same reason, because especially if it's a story you love and know so well, like Romeo and Juliet, and then you start reading something and you're like, oh, okay, 1920s Shanghai, blood feuds. I am in. This is fantastic. Oh, wait. There are monsters in this Romeo and Juliet retelling. Okay. And it just sort of like
Exactly.
keeps going from there. And there are those like similar themes and things that happen, but you do put a very unique spin on it, which I enjoy.
Oh, I'm glad.
Now I think I have heard that you are working on a third book, which sort of set in the same universe. Is that true?
Yes, I have a spin-off duology coming. So it is set in the same world and it follows a character that is in the main cast of These Violent Delights and Our Violent Ends. And the reason why we just haven't announced who it is yet is because we're waiting for Our Violent Ends to come out first. So we're not like, putting more information into the storyline before people have even read the second book. But I'm very excited for that one because it is kind of like I've always been a bit of a genre mixer anyway, but this one I kind of just threw genre out the window. I was like, I'm not gonna, you guys are gonna have such a hard time categorizing this, but it's fine. I kind of describe it as like a Republican era C drama meets a Marvel movie. So it's, I'm still in the final edits of it right now. I have a lot of fun with it, but I'm very excited because, I love like world expansions and I think you know, These Mountains of Lights is a duology. Like, it feels mm-hmm. the most right as a duology. Then there's so much else to work with. So I'm like, oh, spin-off duology. Okay.
No, I think I always love when authors do that, where they have their own where a character that you have met in one book who is not, like you said, like main cast, but not the main character in that book. And then you get all excited because they have their own book coming. So I think it's great. So I will be waiting for Pub Day and shortly thereafter to find out what it's about.
Yes.
I also may...
Fall 2022.
I also may just like ask you when we're done recording and I'll just keep it secret, but that's entirely possible.
The secrets that the listeners can't get to.
I think, you know, like having to categorize it, that's a problem for your publisher, not you. So
exactly. That's the marketing team's problem.
That's their problem. You just write the book. They'll figure it out. So I'm curious, because you did, you know, write this book when you were so, you know, not like so young, but you've been writing for a while, I know from your website. Do you have any suggestions or like recommendations for writers in their teens or 20s who may be listening and are interested in looking to get published?
Mm-mm. I think the first and foremost thing is two things. The first thing is that, especially when you start writing at a young age, you have to just keep going, because a lot of times it can get frustrating when you start and then you're thinking, oh, like my craft doesn't look how I want it to look, right? But you have so much time, like so much time, and you need that time to keep going and growing and getting it to a point where you've understood your craft well enough to get the ideas and stories that you have in your head out. And writing is like, I know that this is cliche, but writing is a muscle, right? It's such a muscle. The more you use it and the more you kind of hone it in, it kicks in faster and faster each time as you go in. But with all that said, the second point is that writers, and especially younger writers, have to stay confident, because I think it's so easy when you're younger to go, oh, like, you know, people don't think I can do this, or, oh, I can do this at a later time, which is true, genuinely, if you wanted to like pick it up later, there's so much time, right? But because there's this like, you know, there's this idea that young writers aren't as good, that young writers are just, you know, kind of not professional enough, all of that, right? It is a major like burden to bear if you're trying to like break into the industry when you're younger. And of course, like, you can do it later on as well, like when most people do it, but if you think you're ready, when you are ready, then you should absolutely do it. There's no reason to wait if you don't want to wait, and as long as you believe in your craft, you can get there and flourish.
Yeah, there you go. No, I think that's true. Like readers and the industry probably, like, I imagine you weren't necessarily like taken seriously when you first started querying for an agent because of your age.
It's an issue. I think I'm just so lucky that like my agent and my editors now are like, you know, they take me just as an equal. Like, my age is just something that's like another factor, just like someone else who, you know, works two other full-time jobs or have four kids. Like, it's just another factor like that to take into account, right? But there are definitely like industry professionals out there who won't take you seriously if you're younger, and they're like, oh, well, you know, you're just a student, like, why are you writing? Or like, oh, you're just a 19-year-old, like, you, there's no way your craft is good in the slightest, I don't want like a child prodigy, right? There are people who don't find anything wrong with having those opinions, and it's like, in that case, you know, those aren't the people you want to work with anyway. Like, you just got to find your champions.
Yeah. That's true. That said, because, you know, you write for a young adult audience, you read young adult, and you also are like so close to that demographic. What, you know, like, what is your experience as someone of that age writing like for that age?
It's a strange experience, because it's very fun sometimes to be able to so directly connect to my readers, right? Because I think the way that they interacted with me is kind of different to how they might interact with, you know, their favorite author who is, you know, in the older generation, because they're not gonna like keyboard smash to like Cassandra Clare. Like, it's just it would be weird, right? Well,
they could, but
she probably wouldn't reply,
right?
Whereas, yeah, like I find it very, very fun to be like, you know, to just interact with readers in the way that I would interact with my friends, because we feel so close, right? But then I think there's that added component onto that, that, you know, the con of me being so easily connected to my readers is that it's, I have a lot of like imposter syndrome with the rest of my peers, because they're all older, not all older, but like most of them are older, and they feel wiser and they feel more mature. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard for me as a like 22-year-old author to kind of wrap my head around the fact that, oh, I'm equals with this person. It always feels like I have to like defer down to them, because I'm like, you know, I don't know anything. But like, you know, I try to have to remind myself, like, yes, I do know what I'm doing. I'm a professional. I can do this. So it's a two sides to it.
That's fair. That would be, I think, hard to struggle with. Yeah, if you have these people you write in the same genre, it's, you know, the YA book community is not, I mean, it's big, but it's also people know each other. And so, yeah, trying to feel on the same level would be tricky. So on your website, you have this in your bio, I think it is, you have this line about how you devoured the entire YA section of your local library, which is then when you started writing your own novels at 13 to keep yourself entertained, yes, which I just love. So because I work for Overdrive and we are a library company, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about your own personal experiences with libraries growing up, because it sounds like you were a big library user.
Yes. Oh, I absolutely was, because I think it had a lot to do with the fact that I grew up in New Zealand. So we get like, you know, physical books come to us very slowly. Most times like in bookstores, I wouldn't actually find the new releases that I was going for, but the libraries would have it. So I was in and out of the libraries quite literally every week. I would come out with like a huge stack of books, like even taller than I was. I would always get comments as I was walking out. People would be like, are you gonna read all those? And I'd be like, yes, I am. Oftentimes I would have a huge, huge stack, and I would finish it by like the Wednesday. And then my mom would be like, we just went to the library. Like, can you please read Sola? Be like, yeah. So it was, libraries was so important to me for like my love of reading. It was just so much more accessible in a way that the bookstores weren't. It was so much more accessible for me as a very fast reader, because I had such a high turnover rate. And you know, the libraries in Auckland were so amazing too, with keeping everything up to date. And I was a Libby app user as well. You know, if I ran a physical book, I was getting the ebooks. So very, it was quintessential.
We like to hear that. So I have had so much fun talking to you. I just have one question left, which is, what do you hope readers take away from reading Our Violent Ends?
Oh, good question.
You're welcome.
I hope that they come away with a sense of like hope and I hope they go away with it feeling like they've read a story about love. Because I feel like this duology as a whole, and especially Our Violent Ends, is about like, how do you love in a place of hate? What do you do when it's actually easier to hate than love, and you want to choose that instead, right? It's very Romeo and Juliet, obviously. Like, I had to go back to the heart of the play. And, you know, the tagline that I write on the copies of Our Violent Ends is Dare to Love. So I think that's kind of captures the essence of the book, and it's the main message, I would say.
It's great. Chloe, thank you so much for coming on the podcast to chat with me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is a joy.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode on Overdrive.com, and our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Jill Grudenwald and presented by Overdrive. To learn more, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number 4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.